Well, we often hear from you about how much you enjoy our wildlife programs, and especially when Scott Craven is with us. And so, you know, what better way to end 2014 and take a look into 2015 than to invite Scott Craven back? Larry Mueller here. So great to have you along on the Ideas Network. He and I are going to be talking a little bit about what's going on, what has gone on in the world of wildlife, and maybe what's in store for us for the future. I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along today, and maybe your own experiences to share. You can call in at 1-800-642-1234. Maybe you have a great wildlife photo you want to share. Well, you can do that. Go to our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you can do it right there. You can also email us with your questions at talk@wpr.org. Scott Craven joins us today from a special place. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Larry. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. And you're in a wonderful place to be talking about wildlife.
I am. I'm sitting in the superintendent's office at the Kemp Station up in Woodruff on the shores of beautiful Lake Tomahawk, which actually just looks like kind of a big open white space right now. But I occupied this office, as you know, for a couple of years when I was filling in for the superintendent back in the late 90s and about 10 years ago. And so I love it here. It's a beautiful place. It's a gem in the university system. And as you say, looking out the window right now at first of all, I'm very thankful I'm on this side of the window.
Yeah.
And secondly, looking out there, it's a winter wonderland, so there are lots of tracks to be seen, and not a great deal of activity today because, the actual temperature when I got up this morning was 13 below. It was 24 below yesterday morning.
Oh.
And the winds are supposed to pick up, but there's lots of snow on the evergreens. The snowmobiling appears to be fantastic, and there are snowmobiles all over the place, so those folks are very happy. So the business folks are very happy, and I think the wildlife is lying low right now, and I don't blame them for that.
Well, but you're not going to don a swimming suit and jump into the lake to welcome the new year in, I take it.
Well, I can't find any open water. I'd certainly consider that. But I think indoors is in my future today. Lots of good football over the next 36 hours.
Yeah, you're right about that. Well, this is a great year for wildlife, wasn't it? In some ways,
it was. It's always a great year, I think, unless there's something catastrophic like the discovery of CWD a decade ago. But for the most part, wildlife populations came through that brutal winter last year, I think better than a lot of people expected, the deer herd in the Northwoods notwithstanding, but most other species made it through pretty well. It was a good year for a lot of populations. A lot of the species we pay a fair bit of attention to because they're popular game species, like waterfowl. Waterfowl numbers were at all-time highs again, and whether you hunt ducks or just like to see ducks swimming around or flying overhead. You know, it was a great year for that. The deer season was a little iffy, and we'll probably talk about that and what the future may hold for the deer hunt. There was, of course, a lot of controversy over the wolf situation, but there were lots of neat side stories, too. I think the publicity that swan from, I think you're familiar with that, Larry, but old swan female with a band, a neck band, 82K with the coat on it. That bird turned 25 last June, and she's still hanging around up in Burnett County. That was one of the original eggs picked up the first year that our Wisconsin biologists were flown to Alaska to pick up trumpeter swan eggs and start the restoration program. And that bird was hatched out at the Milwaukee Zoo and released up in Burnett County, and she's still hanging in there after 25 years. That's pretty remarkable.
That is absolutely amazing.
So there are some heartwarming stories like that, and then the usual controversy with the usual suspects. But the other thing I wanted to mention about 2014 was also a very good year for contributions to the new Cherish Wisconsin Outdoors Fund. some $90,000 has been contributed to that fund. Now those monies are held by the Natural Resources Foundation and used to essentially restore, protect, and manage our cherished places in Wisconsin, our wildlife areas, our state natural areas, our natural heritage sites, those kinds of places that people love and that need some help with inadequate money in the public coffers, so to speak. Things need to be done dealing with everything from endangered species to signage to simple protection and a variety of other things. And this Cherish Fund was created in 2013 to do just that through voluntary contributions. And it seems to be starting to gain momentum. A lot of the funds that have been donated came from $2 donations, often attached to the purchase of hunting and fishing licenses and use of our state parks. So once again, I feel compelled there to credit the hundreds of thousands of people who purchased hunting licenses in Wisconsin. Once again, they're helping fund conservation efforts, but the Cherish Fund is not unique or restricted to hunters or fishers or campers in any way. Anybody, and I think everybody in Wisconsin, should appreciate the kinds of beautiful places we have that need help. And hey, at the end of the year, you got a few extra dollars, send a few dollars in, contribute to the Cherish Fund. It's easy to find online and easy to make the donations, and the money will go to ensure that these places are still out there 50 years or 100 years from now for kids and grandkids and everybody else.
Yeah, so, could still do it today online.
Yeah, that's right. It was a good year all around. A few controversies, which are inevitable, but it was a good year, and we're looking forward to another good one.
Federal judge just put the gray wolf back on the endangered species list in upper Midwest states, including our state, of course. What was the reasoning behind that decision?
Well, ever since the federal government allowed the gray wolf to be taken off the endangered species list in the upper Midwest to return management to the states, which in my humble opinion is where it should be. But nevertheless, that was done. That was met with great enthusiasm, I think, in most of the wolf states, at least among state biologists who saw a need for active management of the wolf population, and I think also were in general agreement that the wolf population was at a point where management activities to reduce detrimental impacts like livestock depredation or dog killing or other negative interactions with people, that management to address those problems would not negatively affect the viability of the wolf population, that wolves were here to stay, that they could sustain that level of management, or that's kind of a euphemism for removal of wolves from the population, especially problem animals.
Yeah.
That was sustainable, and that management now resided where it should, which is in the states that support wolf populations. Well, that, of course, didn't sit well with a variety of animal protection or wolf advocacy groups, and there have been a number of legal challenges since that ruling. This, I think, the fourth one. And this time around, I have no idea who the judge was or what the judge's thought processes were. Presumably, the judge looked at the information presented, and the ruling was made that, in fact, the population, that the animal should be back on the under Endangered Species Act federal protection. And the ruling stated, as I understand it, that state regulation, in the judge's opinion, state regulation was inadequate and that wolves still inhabit only a fraction of their former range. Now, if that is a measure being used to monitor the success of wolf restoration, we are never, ever going to get there.
No.
Because very few animals, especially predators, come even close to occupying their pre-settlement range. The landscape simply will not allow it. And part of the ruling was that protection would allow wolves to disperse and repopulate into states neighboring Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. But, I mean, the thought that wolves are going to repopulate Illinois or Indiana or whatever, it's not going to happen.
No.
Those states simply don't have, yes, it may have been former wolf range. Most of North America was, if you go back far enough. But if you go back far enough, there were a lot of animals on the landscape that are not here anymore. And that's just a function of the human footprint on the landscape. That's the way it is. And there's little or nothing anyone can do about that, no matter which side of the debate they're on. So I just don't view that notion that wolves need to occupy more of their former range as being particularly viable. So it's a very contentious issue. The wolf situation remains contentious. There was a tremendous amount of fuss made over the fact that the harvest quota was exceeded again in Wisconsin. But that, too, I guess the two things that bother me the most in this is, number one, a judge. I mean, I respect the judicial system, but when it comes to wildlife, management as close to home where the wildlife lives, I think, tends to be the best management. And management based on science tends to be the best management. And management that takes into consideration all of the different interest groups and stakeholders tends to be the best management. And when the management is directed by a single individual 1,000 miles away in a courtroom in Washington, I find that just a little disturbing, having been involved with wildlife management for a long time. I mean, not necessarily as much disturbing as it is frustrating.
No.
And then the other issue is this notion of the quota being exceeded. Frankly, since the first year of the hunt in 2012 in Wisconsin, when the quota was 115 and 116 were taken, I think for the most part, everybody marveled at how can they come that close, you know, given what we see in other hunts and you know, predictions that are kind of all over the map. That was amazing. And then it was 257 taken for a quota of 251 in 2013, a difference of 6 and a difference of 4 with the season closing just earlier in December, 154 versus 150. Yes, it's true that those numbers exceeded the quota, but let's be reasonable here. We're only talking about 1-3% for something as difficult to manage as this situation. You know, I agree that at one of these bowl games that's decided 48-47 on a last-minute field goal, that's only 1 point, but that's an all-or-nothing situation. In this case, we're only talking about literally 1-6 animals.
Yeah.
Out of a large quota, and not factored into that is a look at how many animals were being taken as part of control activities to deal with livestock depredations, how many animals were hit by cars or killed in other ways.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, there's a tremendous emphasis on this essentially insignificant number of animals just because I think you can point a finger at the managers and said, hey, they went the wrong way, and yet it's insignificant. But anyway, that's the nature of the wolf business these days, and I don't know where this will play out. I guess there's room for an appeal here by the federal government. Whether that will meet with any success or not, I have no idea. But for the time being, wolves are back on the endangered species list. Therefore, the hunt will be held in abeyance. And number two, I suspect my suspicion is that the things that have largely been out of the media for the past couple of years, and that being people, especially in primary wolf range in the North Woods, being very excited about things like losing hunting dogs or trailing dogs or farmers losing livestock, we'll start to see that kind of thing creeping back in the news again, and that's not a good development. So anyway, that's kind of the situation.
Let's take up some other topics here, Scott. And there's lots, I think, that we can talk about here. And one relates to eagles. Kristen in Eau Claire saw a lot more eagles this past year in western Wisconsin. How are the populations coming along overall?
The eagle population is doing very, very well. And they've expanded their range so that it's It's common now, for example, where I've been, you know, hunting for years right out in Iowa County, just west of Madison. There's an eagle nest along Trout Creek in the town of Barneveld now, and that every day that I was out there this fall, those adult eagles were sitting in a cottonwood tree along Trout Creek, and it became just a regular thing. And hey, there's eagles back here. And when I started out there, when I came out here, moved out here from New England to go to graduate school, I mean, an eagle sighting along the Wisconsin River was cause for, wow,
yeah,
an eagle.
Yeah.
And in fact, it's become a common sight, and that just again reflects the kind of successes that managers have had in terms of offering up the protection that in this case, these birds needed from environmental contaminants and other problems, and the birds responded. The same as the reflection of poor old swan 82K that we were talking about a moment ago, reflecting a situation where we went from trumpeter swans were gone, there were no trumpeter swans. Now the population is estimated at more than 2,000 in the state. So on the one hand, we kind of talk out of both sides of our mouths. We look at these tremendous success stories like the trumpeter swan or the eagles recovering or the wild turkey population, and all the result really of the same professional wildlife management strategies that are in fact trying to manage the wolves. But well, you see where I'm headed with that. It's a bizarre quirk in human nature.
Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer, on this last day of the year on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, with us to talk about Wisconsin wildlife. Talked a bit about wolves. Want to expand the conversation and talk about a whole lot more. So we got into a little bit about eagles. What about pheasants? There was a Facebook question from Gary, who used to see lots of pheasants when traveling around country roads. Not so many anymore. He says, we have 73 acres of prairie marsh and have had lots of pheasants 10 to 15 years ago, but not anymore, despite even we planted some. Where have all the pheasants gone, Scott?
Where have all the pheasants gone? Well, The wild pheasant population really took a hit with winter and spring weather, which was unfavorable the last two or three years. It was really a couple of years ago. Like the observers you just mentioned on the prairie restoration around my house south of Madison, for five or six winters in a row or 5 or 6 years in a row, there were birds all around the prairie visiting the backyard. Cocks were crowing in the spring. It was terrific. In the winter, we had rooster pheasants coming up on the deck railing to the bird feeders. And I mean, that's a spectacular bird to have at the bird feeder. And it was really cool. And then I think it was two springs ago, we had all the rain and sleet and cold into May after a tough winter. And that simply took them out. And I've not, around my property, where, as I said, we had quite a few pheasants, I've not seen or heard a bird for two straight years. And last winter wasn't particularly good either. This winter has now gotten pretty cold, although December was pretty moderate. So who knows where that'll head. There's enough birds around in very good habitat. Some of the pheasant restoration work that some of the DNR wildlife managers have been doing in places like Rock County and Greene County and across the southern part of the state do hold wild birds. And if weather's conducive to things and CRP acres, Conservation Reserve Program acres, remain on the landscape, those birds will eventually spread out and repopulate and people will start to see them again. But it's a slow process of recovery. The bright spot in the meantime, especially for people who hunt pheasants, is the decision made by DNR administration a couple of years ago to boost pheasant production at the state game farm at Poinette and almost increase it by pretty close to 50%, I guess, up to some 75,000 birds from about 50,000, somewhere in that area. And so people utilizing the public hunting grounds that are scattered across most of the southern two-thirds of Wisconsin saw good numbers of pheasants because they were being stalked by the agency for hunting purposes. And, of course, those birds do move off of the public hunting grounds, and other people get a chance to see them as well. So pheasant situation is kind of a mixed blessing. On the public lands where they've been stalked, things have been pretty good. On other lands where winter has played out and Mother Nature's had a big effect, the wild pheasant population's taken a big hit in a lot of places.
Oh, there you go. Stephen Danbury, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Just a couple comments about the wolf. I live in wolf country here. I have wolves on my property from time to time. I've had wolves walking across the pond in front of my house. I don't belong to any groups of any kind, but I think I reflect the opinion of at least some people here in the north that, and I want to say, Scott, you compared the wolf reintroduction to several other species, all of which were prey rather than predator animals, mm-hmm. I think. So it's kind of an apples and oranges comparison, I think. The wolf is controversial because it's a predator. I think those of us who have watched the numbers grow here who lived for the day when we would have wolves here again are a little mistrustful of the whole system. We know that the stated goal of a lot of people and groups in this part of the state is to rid the area of wolves, not to have wolves, but to get rid of them. You see it on bumper stickers all over. So when we hear that the kill went over the allowable limit or the set goal, we get a little bit twitchy, especially knowing that there are far more wolves probably killed than those numbers reflect, whether it's just some guy who mistakes a wolf for a coyote or someone who sees a wolf on their property and doesn't want it around anymore. These things happen.
Right.
Yeah. Scott, a comment?
Well, no, he's absolutely right. And if you look at the, it was not too many months ago that the DNR social scientists came out with their report on wolf attitudes and so forth across the state, and especially in northern Wisconsin. And the caller is absolutely right. Most people in the North Woods, and even in some counties, a majority of hunters are supportive of wolves being around. Most people, including me, like the idea that wolves are back as part of the fauna and wildlife landscape of Wisconsin. They were here, and they belong here, and they have a role to play. It's only when you start to get down to people debating, well, okay, so we've got wolves, that's okay, but how many do we really want or need? Is 200 enough? Maybe 2,000? What's the deal? And then all of a sudden, things begin to break down, and the groups that tend to get most of the attention are either the bumper sticker types who, you know, the only good wolf is a dead wolf, or the folks on the other side who don't want to see a single wolf harmed, removed, or dealt with for any reason, where in fact, as with many wildlife problems, the silent majority, like the caller we just talked to, are quite content to know they're around, don't feel threatened by them at all, and, you know, things, and they're rightfully a little suspicious. But I would like to think that at some point the groups can come together enough to reach some strategy, some goal number that will both allow wolves to persist on the Wisconsin landscape and allow people the chance to cut a set of tracks while they're hiking on a sandy trail or see one occasionally or hear them howling, but at the same time try and minimize some of the negative effects that justifiably concern other segments of the population, like the folks with losing pets or the livestock industry. So
yeah, there you go.
It's a tough balancing act, but there are, I think, the folks who are of the mindset that, no, we don't want wolves in Wisconsin, period. That's a very small minority, if it exists at all in more than a handful of people.
Yeah. Thanks again, Steve, for calling. And Maybe one more comment on wolves from Ann in Madison. Ann, hi. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi. Well, I just wanted to say that it seems to me, because the destruction of the habitat of so many wild creatures by human beings is the problem, I wish we were doing more to prevent development and the, you know, establishment of big grazing operations and so forth in areas that used to be wolf habitat. And we human beings seem to think that we're the kings and we can multiply as much as we want, and all other creatures have to be managed by, usually by shooting them, if there are too many of them for us to handle conveniently. And I think if you ask the wolf what the wolf thought was the problem, they would say these darn human beings, you know, with their guns and their development and their destruction of our habitat, if only they would leave nature alone a bit more, we wouldn't want to have anything to do with them, and we'd have plenty of habitat to, you know, to thrive. But they seem to sort of control their own populations.
So, Scott, what do you think?
Well, she's right. It is fundamentally most of the problems that wildlife populations face, no matter what they are, not just big predators or game animals, but all wildlife. Most problems relate to, sooner or later, back to people, whether it's environmental contamination, whether it's habitat degradation, whatever. And the second reality is that the managers, the people responsible for taking care of our wildlife, for all of us, because it's a public trust resource, know that very well. But unless and until people are willing to stop building houses or stop wanting a second home in the North Woods or stop wanting new roads or better roads or whatever, that, unfortunately, is going to continue. And I just don't see many people stepping up to say, well, you know, here my house is occupying what was a former oak savanna in Dane County. It's time for me to move to a condo in the city and bulldoze the house and let the restoration begin.
Yeah, you're not going to find that.
You're just not going to find that. And for better or for worse, we are humans. We are a very, very abundant species, and we have a big, heavy footprint on the landscape. And that's the reality that wildlife and wildlife managers and people who care about wildlife have to contend with.
And again, thanks for calling, Ann. Appreciate your call. We're going to move on to some other topics as well here.
Hey, Larry, have you had anything to cook from the fields and forests lately?
Oh, you know, I've got lots of good things to talk about with that.
Okay.
But I want to give Roger from Spring Green has got a story to tell us that I think might be kind of fun at this moment. Roger, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, I'm calling with a fun story that I've wanted to share with both of you guys for a while, and I found a good day to do it. So I live out near Spring Green, and one night, we were driving on a road that's parallel to railroad tracks, about 40, 50 yards away from the road. And there was a train just a little bit ahead of us, and all of a sudden, some small, medium-sized animal ran across the road incredibly fast. And Ernie and I saw it, and we said, was that a cat? Was that a raccoon? It looked we couldn't figure out, and it, like, looked very, it wasn't quite right for a cat, wasn't quite right for a raccoon. And then at the same time, we both figured out that was a skunk. And neither one of us had ever seen a skunk run at full bore because they have such a great defense mechanism. They're not scared of anything except for trains.
Uh-huh. Well, I that's a good point. I guess every skunk I've ever seen was just sort of ambling around and didn't seem like it had a care in the world. But I'm guessing faced with a train hurtling along, maybe the skunk thought it was time to change tactics.
That was my question, Scott. Have you ever seen a skunk running at full bore?
No.
No, I haven't either. No,
even releasing them from a live trap or whatnot, you know, they just sort of, rather than most things like a rabbit or a coon or a squirrel released from a trap, zoom, it's just gone like it was shot out of a spring-loaded cannon. But in the case of a skunk, they just sort of amble on. Something to hide under. Yep. But the train must have put a bit of a fright into that skunk.
Yeah, I think vibrating ground changed their attitude a bit.
That is a good story.
Thanks, Roger.
Yep, Happy New Year, Bob.
Yeah, Happy New Year to you as well. Terry in Green Bay, let's turn to you next. Hi, Terry. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I'd like to ask Scott a question. I've got pheasants coming into my bird feeder here. I've got about 20 acres of property where I live north of Green Bay. There's anywhere from 5, sometimes 10 pheasants out there, but my bird feeder is where I feed. Is there any type of natural, like, protection I could put back in my brush and where I've got some thick evergreens and stuff, you know, something that would give them a little protection from this harsh, cold wind?
So can he build a shelter of some sort?
Build the straw or cut down some, you know, boughs from some of my evergreens or whatever.
If you've got evergreens, I mean, that's a good start right there. What they really like for winter cover is a good either brushy or cattail, a little bit of cattail marsh, a little brushy sedge meadow, some really heavy cover that they can move around in, prairie grass that's still up and hasn't been knocked down by snow, those kinds of things. But in terms of what you can do here, kind of obviously you can't plant or grow anything at this point, but it's quite possible if you've got one of those evergreens. By evergreens, are we talking spruce or pine or?
Kind of a mixture.
These are big mature trees or are there some smaller ones?
They're larger. They're all pretty much larger.
Well, you know, I could imagine, for example, if there's one that's either blocked your view or too close to your trail or whatever, if you were willing to sacrifice one or two and kind of hinge cut them, so that they come down, and but will stay alive because they're only hinge cut. In other words, you chainsaw, but don't cut them all the way through, just enough to break them over. They'll stay alive, and that dense cover close to the ground might be the easiest and quickest thing you could do. Depending on the setting around your home, it may not be the most aesthetically appealing thing to do, but I'm guessing that quite a few things, from the pheasants to rabbits and a variety of other small animals, would use that cover that would be instantly provided close to the ground. Other possibility is to take some brush and make some lean-tos, either by, again, felling a sapling and then laying some brush up against it at an angle. Make some lean-tos that you can spread a little seed and whatnot under. That will keep the snow off the feed, which the pheasants will appreciate. But if there's some straw or light brush and so forth in there, that's also a little bit of shelter that might be provided for them. But you're lucky to have them, and I'm envious. I'd sure like to see a few back around my prairie.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it, Terry. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234 if you've got some great wildlife photos and questions. Love to see them on our Facebook page. Go to the Larry Mueller Show for that. And let's take a look at Arlen next from Oconto County. Hi, Arlen. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry and Scott. I've got a question regarding otters.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been my understanding that the only time otters again is when the female is having young, and that would be starting in February and March. And when I was muzzleloader hunting the first week of December, I found an active, fresh active otter den right next to a creek.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 weeks later, I went back into that area just to check on it. I just wanted to look at it again, and it was abandoned at that point. I have no idea what that means or what that's about. What can you say to that?
Well, Arlen, I'm probably going to share your opinion of not knowing what that's all about. You know, the otters do move about the landscape a bit, and their movements and seeing their slides and runs and all is something that people enjoy. as they move from water source to water source. So that may have been a den that they or it were occupying temporarily because it was, hey, the stream was good. Maybe there were a lot of fish in it or whatever, and they holed up there. Fish supply dried up, moved, whatever, and so did the otters. I can't tell you a whole lot more than that.
Mm.
Some of these things happened, and our curiosity for us probably made great sense to the otters at the time, but beyond that, I'm not sure. Now, the more suspicious among us, you know, might suspect, gee, what happened here? I don't know enough about the, and I don't have it here in front of me in terms of what the trapping season is to know if that was open at the time or not, that an animal may have been removed or that there was some other problem with the predation or a couple of otters disputing territory. There are lots, bottom line is, lots of possibilities, some just fine and part of the otter's daily life, some maybe not so fine as far as the otter was concerned, but in this case, most people choose to think positively and, well, you know, for whatever reason, the otters moved on and they got another den somewhere else.
There you go. Arlen, thank you very much for calling. You know, someone else called, this goes back to the shelters for the pheasants. Someone else called and said, hey, how about those Christmas trees that everybody's probably now getting rid of?
It's a possibility, and you could accomplish the same thing as I suggested with the hinge cut on an evergreen, but the difficulty with the Christmas trees is, number one, by the time people get rid of them, they're usually really dry and brittle and whatnot, and not particularly comfortable, I would think. And in addition, most of the contemporary plantation-grown Christmas trees are so dense and thick that, you know, there's not as many spaces and cavities and so forth as there would be with those more mature natural trees cut down. But certainly utilizing discarded Christmas trees to create a brush pile or a little shelter from the wind, whether it will benefit the pheasants or not, it will certainly benefit from some other stuff. We have ours that, you know, as you know, Larry, we usually put up a big one in that
great big one
living room. So that's now out, leaning up against the deck, and the birds coming to the feeders where there are otherwise no evergreens right around the house, that becomes a favorite spot for them now for the rest of the winter, and then I'll get rid of the tree in the spring. So, yes, good idea. Recycling Christmas trees is a great thing to do.
Tom and Baldwin, hi, thanks for calling.
Good morning. My name is Tom. I have a tree farm. This is kind of a follow-on to your last question. We have a tree farm where we raise conifers, but we raise them for the landscape industry, so mm-hmm. we don't shear them as tightly as do the Christmas tree guys.
Right.
But we do have to do a bit of thinning and disease trees and things like that. And if I've been making piles of those for the wildlife, what's the best architecture there for size and distance between piles and things like that? How do I handle these trees for the best for the advantage to wildlife?
Well, if we were thinking about just putting the Christmas trees aside for a moment as just some type of brush to use, the architecture recommended for a brush pile is to start with a base of the largest stock that you have. In other words, some pretty good-sized logs or heavy brush or even some old pallets or construction debris, whatever, as a base and placed to the extent that you can. Let's say you had a supply in an ideal world of 10-foot, 4, 5, 6-inch diameter logs. You start with a base of a layer of those lying on the ground, separated from each other by 5, 6, 7, 8 inches, then another layer perpendicular to the first layer, crisscrossed, and maybe a second or third or fourth layer, depending on how many you have or what you have. Bottom line, you're creating a network close to the ground of spaces and cavities. Then all of your loose brush, Christmas trees and so forth, are piled teepee fashion on top of that infrastructure. And the teepee fashion sheds the weather and water a little better. But what it provides is essentially a nice, tight roof over all those cavities and living spaces that you've provided by weaving in the network underneath. And most of the recommendations, I mean, anything's better than nothing, but brush piles up to 20, 25 feet in diameter are just fine. And in terms of the spacing or the number, probably more determined by what you have for material to work with than anything else. And if you can put them along an existing fence row or travel lane so that the wildlife using them doesn't have to expose themselves by zooming across, you know, 50 yards of open, bare field where they'd be exposed to all sorts of predators and other hazards, that also will help a little bit in terms of their use. So a network of nice, good-sized piles like that stretched along a property line or a fence row that adjoins some brush or woods, and maybe they're, 50 or 100 yards apart, boy, that would be... That'd be a pretty nice setup.
Wildlife, oh, man, would it ever.
Wildlife paradise.
What kind of animals would be most likely to be seen?
Well, I would say that it's a shorter list to try and describe the animals that might not use the brush pile. Virtually any of our small mammals, from shrews to mice and voles and all those things that remain active throughout the winter, will certainly be in there.
Rabbits.
Rabbits will love it. Squirrels will use it. In the warmer seasons, the chipmunks, the ground squirrels, and even salamanders, snakes, skinks, and a variety of other things would use it during the warmer season. And then a variety of small birds, you know, things like chickadees and juncos and whatnot that are around ground level anyway, would certainly get in there for both shelter and to look for insects and whatnot. And the small predators, weasels, fox, all sorts of things will certainly visit them, because what you've essentially created is a food resource for everything eats something. And you just go on up the line, and the local raccoons, possums, skunks, all of them would utilize that at one time.
Birds.
Yep.
Yeah. So you, boy, whatever you can do, Tom, you're going to have a fun time observing. It sounds like you've got an ideal situation. I want to thank you so much for calling today. And I hadn't heard your description, Scott, and that was a great description of how to build a kind of a wood pile shelter. That's one we have never, I don't think, ever talked about on the show before. So
we probably haven't, but it's written up in some of the, you know, kind of backyard wildlife guides, and the advantage is that provides a brush pile that will maintain some structural integrity for many years.
Yeah,
that stuff underneath holds everything else up. Just a big pile of Christmas trees will eventually collapse upon itself, and there's really nothing in there. But with an infrastructure, it works pretty good.
Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network as we talk the world of wildlife with wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. You can join in. Number to call, 800-642-1234. You can also go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show and post your wildlife photos and questions there. Nathan in Sun Prairie, thanks for waiting. Hi.
Hi, Larry and Scott. Love the show. Like to tune in whenever possible.
Thank you.
I told my wife I would be calling you as soon as this next incident that I'm about to tell you happened. I told her I was going to call you guys to help me sort out this issue. Last week in Sawyer County, we do our annual hike through one of the state natural areas, try to get lost, and then once we're lost, we pull out the compass and try to find our way back home again. So we're accustomed to looking at animal tracks in winter snow. Last week, when we were hiking through this natural area, we came upon some white-tailed deer prints, and I thought my wife was crazy when she told me this, but she asked me to bend down and look at these tracks. Around each one of the tracks was maybe 50 to 100 living, what I'm assuming were fleas, that had dropped off the white-tailed deer. So my question is this common to see a white-tailed deer that is so infested with living fleas that they're literally dropping at every footprint? And if so, can we assume that this was a really stressed-out animal, that it was possibly this infested with fleas?
I think you may be misinterpreting what you saw, Nathan. At least that's my opinion. Well, Scott, what do you think?
Well, you continue that. See which way you're headed, Larry, and then see if we were headed in the same direction.
Well, I think that we were just talking about this yesterday on the show with Phil Pelletieri. There are a lot of insects that come to life in the wintertime, and there are many of them. And I'm thinking that possibly because of the steps, maybe there was a little warmer spot for them to congregate. I'm not sure.
Well, are you thinking snow fleas? Or?
Yeah, I was thinking snow fleas.
Yeah, that's what I thought of at first. But, you know, those are sometimes, regardless of animal prints, you may just see snow fleas congregated on the sunny exposure on a snowdrift or something like that.
Yeah.
I can't imagine that the certainly deer can be affected with a variety of things, and from fleas to ticks and a variety of other ectoparasites. But I can't imagine being so covered that every step in the snow, especially as delicate as deer tend to be, would dislodge a quantity of how many? So there's a deer print in the snow. How many fleas are we talking about, Nathan? A couple or dozens?
I'm looking at a picture of it, and we took more than one picture. There was maybe 50 to 100 fleas around there, congregated around every footprint.
They would not have come off the deer.
How many prints are we talking about? For like 10 yards or 10 feet or?
Well, in the space we happened to be looking at, it was probably 10 yards worth, and it was under a canopy. It was under a mixed hemlock forest.
Hmm.
I still think it's snow fleas.
Well, I have to think it's something other than something coming off the deer, because for one thing, the legs of the deer, I'm assuming the snow was what, 8 inches deep, 10 inches deep under the canopy?
6 to 8.
Yeah, so that the deer was not getting up above even what we'd perceive as its knees. And that lower leg, the part penetrating the snow, is not very vascular, not very meaty, and not the place where ectoparasites like fleas would normally be either attached or hanging on, which would be more the main body mass of the animal. So I've got to think that they were walking through there, and as Larry suggests, dislodging something that was in that environment anyway. You know, it's all after the fact now, but I wonder, you know, if you look behind in your own prints or had revisited the site or dug around a little bit, if you might have discovered these fleas, you know, exclusive of the deer track. I can't think of any reason that the fleas would be dislodged in those kinds of numbers, even if they were on the deer. And that just seems like an incredible infestation of all the deer that I've processed, either for myself or people or, you know, dealt with in the woods or whatever else. I guess now that I think about it, lots of ticks, but a flea is an unusual sighting. I don't know, you, Larry, you've handled a bunch of deer, too. I don't ever remember seeing one that was...
I don't remember seeing any on a deer that I've...
No, that's true, too. So I think this is one where we have to turn to the audience. I know there are lots of lots of really top-notch naturalists and some of our DNR colleagues and whatnot listen to the program, and if anybody has a speculation as to how or why these observed fleas might have somehow been related to the deer passing through, hey, call in and give us some help here. But I think it was two unrelated situations.
Yeah. So stay listening, Nathan, and thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. You know, I hear we were going to talk about wild game cooking, and we can still do that after our break. But we've even posted, Judith posted on our Facebook page, a couple of venison recipes. Or did you, Judith, did you put the third one up as well? Okay. We've got two venison recipes, venison stroganoff and venison scallopini. I've done both of them many times, and they're both outstanding. I know, Scott, you've done them.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to we're going to, for anybody, go to our Facebook page. If you have some venison, I hope you'll go to the Facebook page and take a look at the stroganoff and the scallopini recipes, because they're both excellent recipes. But we're going to talk also some more about cooking. And Scott, you've done probably, you've got a lot of venison at home.
Well, I don't know about a lot. My son and I were reasonably successful this year. You know, after I missed the whole season last year because of illness issues, it was great to be back out. We do have some venison, and I'm looking forward. I've got quite a quantity over at the local meat processing facility, having some sausage made, so I'm looking forward to getting that back. And I do enjoy cooking and eating venison, so we should. Lots of people around Wisconsin at the tail end of the hunting seasons here have game of all sorts in their freezers, so I think it would be a good idea to offer up some tips and tricks for everything from processing and storage to cooking, and share some recipes. That'll be fun.
I think that'll be a lot of fun as well. And, of course, we'll take your suggestions and, you know, what are your favorite recipes, too? And as well, keep our conversation going on the wildlife here in the state of Wisconsin. Scott Craven, a wildlife ecologist, our guest. You can join us at 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. News coming up, and then we'll be back with Scott here on the Ideas Network. Hard to imagine, but we've got less than 12 hours, just a little less than 12 hours to go before 2014 is history. For me, it's probably, you know, it's kind of a mixed year for me. I had some bad and some good. Maybe that's the way your year went as well. It's been a fairly good year for our wildlife. Well, it always is. And Scott Craven, our guest today, is ready and willing, as always, to talk about the world of wildlife with us. You can join in, 800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org. We've posted sort of the end of the year. We've decided to talk a little bit about wild game cooking, and Judith posted a couple of my recipes up, one for venison stroganoff, which is an easy recipe to do, and the other, a venison scallopini, which is almost as easy to do, both very, very tasty. And that's kind of the good thing, Scott, isn't it, about hunting? The chance, one of the good things is the chance to eat what you get.
Well, that's really the payoff for most hunters. That's where the whole thing comes full circle, and you sit down to a meal where the centerpiece is a pheasant breast or a venison chop or a stew or anything produced from the game that you've harvested, and a chance to share that and enjoy it and kind of relive the hunt and the memories associated with it. That's really the culmination of the whole thing. And it's an important driving force for quite a few hunters, and it's become a very important driving force for new hunter recruitment as the locavore movement, the slow foods, the wild, you know, non-steroid-influenced game meat, has become very popular. So all in all, especially in a state like Wisconsin, where we have lots and lots of hunters and abundant game, it's an important thing because people want to get the most out of what they've harvested and really put something on the table that's a quality, enjoyable, tasty product.
Yeah, I think it's really a lot of fun to prepare something like a stroganoff, and people just delight in it.
Well, they do, that stroganoff recipe. And, you know, we that's really how we got started together. God, it must be 35 years ago now when we were teaching that game cooking class for UW Extension. And, boy, we had some fun evenings with those people preparing all sorts of different game recipes. And that stroganoff one was one we used all the time. And with my when Candy's and my kids were growing up, that venison stroganoff was the go-to recipe because it was so easy. And you could use just about any cut of venison in it, and the kids loved it. So, and there were lots of recipes like that. And the fact of the matter is that most hunters, at least the ones in the circles I travel in, are surprisingly good cooks and really enjoy preparing what they've harvested. So it is, especially this time of year, in a time of abundance, as far as the season's winding down, it's a very common thing around the state.
Yeah, I think so as well. And I mean, just as you think about it, Scott, some general cooking tips come to mind for you with game.
Well, the whole thing starts back with the field care, when the animals were killed, were harvested, that the hunter took proper precautions to in the field dressing and to avoid contamination, keep them refrigerated or cold, and essentially get them back home in the best possible condition, and then deal with processing again in good, clean conditions, and getting something into the freezer or into the refrigerator in as good a shape as it could be, both from the standpoint of being clean and sanitary, but also free of bullet fragments, hair, feathers, all the kinds of things that can kind of, at least for me, take the edge off enjoying a meal when you're served a venison stew. And, oh, what's that interesting garnish? And the garnish proves to be deer hair. That's a real dietary turnoff, as far as I'm concerned. So it is very important, the steps leading up to that package of venison in the freezer that you're going to use in the stroganoff recipe. When you take that out, you want to be, I think most people want to be reasonably assured that it's a clean, good, quality piece of meat, and you don't have to worry about chomping down on a bone fragment or a bullet fragment or something else. Other tips, some of the basic ones that I kind of live by is I very rarely freeze bone-in meat anymore, especially with the venison in the area where I hunt and chronic wasting disease. Everything's boned. Bone takes up freezer space and punctures freezer paper wrapping and so forth, so I tend to bone everything, with the exception of things like pheasant legs, game bird legs. I like to accumulate separate from the breast meat so that when I've got a bag of 6 or 8 pheasant legs, then I can cook those separately, usually with some type of slow, moist cooking, even boiling them, to get the meat off of the bone, and then you can clean it out and make sure there are no feathers, bone fragments, shot pellets, or whatever, and then that meat is used for soups and stews and pot pies and things like that, as opposed to trying to cook a pheasant leg with a pheasant breast, which is not a simple situation. A boneless, skinless game bird breast, be it a grouse or pheasant or what have you,
is very similar in appearance
to a boneless, skinless chicken breast that everybody's familiar with, and you can do about the same things with them. So the processing is really important. I think the next things that are important are to not overcook anything. These game meats are reasonably delicate, and a prime butterfly chop from a boneless backstrap of venison is the premier cut as far as I'm concerned. And to see that cooked well done and gray and have the texture of
That's too bad.
It's a shame. It's a waste of an opportunity. So those meats can and should be cooked medium rare at best, and that's where you get the most flavor, the best texture, and really the best presentation all around. So generally, not overcooking. Make sure they're clean and well prepared to avoid contamination. And then I think the other thing, especially for people who don't get a lot of game or are putting on a dinner they want to share with someone who doesn't eat game very often, is to select a recipe where the game meat is actually allowed to shine and display its normal flavor. In other words, having somebody over while ground venison is very popular and used in venison chili or spaghetti or any other ground meat preparation is fine, and it's a good way to get the venison into your normal food string. That tends to really conceal the flavor and texture of the venison. So what I'm suggesting is for a special dinner, maybe New Year's Eve dinner tonight, serve a venison chop or a pheasant breast or something as a venison chop or a pheasant breast with some type of a light or minimal sauce or whatever, so that you can really enjoy it for what it is what I'm getting at, yeah. rather than using it in a heavy sauce or something very spicy, you know, a Mexican dish or something like that, where you really can't. Yeah, it's a protein, it's a meat, but it could be a venison chop, it could be a water buffalo chop, who knows?
Those are some of the
basic things, and beyond that, once you've got the game meat, it is a quality product. It's nutritious. It's from a whatever standpoint you want to examine it, fat content, cholesterol levels, nutrient content. It's good, healthy meat. And if it's treated properly, it's really a delight on the table.
Yeah, absolutely. And seasonings and herbs, pretty much what you would, I think, use for other, for beef or whatever, if you're talking venison, again, not overdoing it.
Yeah, not overdoing it and using what you like. If you start with ingredients that you enjoy, what's the old saying? If you can't fix it with wine, onions, or garlic, it isn't worth fixing kind of thing. Stuff that you like with a good quality product, you can't really go too far wrong. One other thing that comes to mind, especially with birds, be it waterfowl or upland game like pheasants, is the thought, especially for some of the beginning hunters we work with, they want to pluck the bird and think that they're going to, we'll get it all plucked so it'll look like a chicken from the grocery store and then we'll roast it. I realize that's possible, and some people like to do it, but you cut yourself in for a lot of work. It's very difficult to do and do it well, and you run into the problem that I mentioned a minute ago, that cooking the breast meat and the leg meat is sometimes a challenge to get them both the way you want them. And in addition, by not skinning those birds or by just filleting off the breast meat, you lose the opportunity to find some of those shot pellets, some of those feathers that are taken into the meat by the shot tract from the bird shot, and other kinds of things that when you skin them or fillet them out, you find all that stuff and remove it. And you can always take a pheasant breast and wrap it with some domestic chicken skin, which the grocery stores will be happy to give you, or you just save when you're cooking a chicken or have some chicken thighs or whatever in the house. Save that skin. Wrap that around your game bird and secure it with toothpicks, and away you go, and you cut yourself in or save yourself a lot of work.
A lot of work.
Fucking these things and making a heck of a mess in the garage, which you're going to get yelled at for.
Yeah, exactly. On that note, let's turn to Jim in East Troy. Jim, thanks for waiting.
Hi. Hey, I've got a question relating to your original topic, Wolves. I watched a documentary, I think it was a National Geographic, a few months ago, and it was entitled Coy Wolves, and it was the eastern timber wolf mating with coyotes.
Uh-huh.
And the premise was that they're pretty clever and pretty prolific offspring, and they were moving west. And now, I don't know how old this documentary was. It may not have been a couple of months old. It may have been a year or two. Anything in Wisconsin or Michigan or Pennsylvania?
Yeah, about.
Well, there are hybridization among members of the canid family. It does happen, and there are coy wolves, there are coy dogs, there are wolf dog hybrids, but that seemed to get a lot more play a number of years ago when wolves were first starting to repopulate and coyotes were marching east. I don't hear much about it anymore, and I think it's been swamped by the more powerful interaction between the members of the dog family, and that simply is they don't play well together. And given the opportunity, wolves will drive coyotes out of their territory, kill them if they can, just as coyotes will do the same thing to red fox. And so there's two very different but very powerful interactions there. One might be the possibility of interbreeding, but I think the circumstances have to be just right for that, because more often I think the reaction is aggressive, antagonistic, and can be fatal to the smaller canid. So it can happen biologically, but it doesn't seem to be a big deal on the landscape anymore, and I don't know why.
There we go, Jim. Thanks. Chris in Brookfield, your turn. Thank you for waiting. Hi.
Guy, how are you doing?
Good.
Good.
Good. I just had a question about DNR nesting of eagles in Milwaukee. I'm just wondering, I'm in Brookfield, and I have an eagle that flies over the house probably every other day I see it. So I'm just wondering, do you know if the DNR has been nesting eagles in Milwaukee, or why would there be a bald eagle this year?
Well, they've been doing it on their own.
Well, they're doing it on their own. There's no effort by the DNR to move eagles or encourage eagles around the landscape anymore because they're just doing so well on their own. The fact that there are eagles, you know, as we mentioned earlier, nesting in areas of southern Wisconsin where they haven't for a long time is just a reflection of the population growing and expanding over larger areas. But this time of year, you could see an eagle just about anywhere, especially in conjunction with open water. So the prime viewing areas for eagles are along the lower Wisconsin River, around Prairie du Sac and Sauk City, up at Pettenwell and Castle Rock, and further south along the Wisconsin River, along the Great Lakes shoreline, and really anywhere where there's open water. My wife and I were running an errand in Madison either yesterday or the day before, and she said, hey, that looks like an eagle. And there was an eagle flying along Park Street, probably headed for a little open water still around the Madison Lakes. So it would not surprise me to see a bald eagle virtually anywhere in the state at this point, and especially in the winter when nesting really isn't the issue, and that bird may have nothing whatsoever to do with, you know, with a nesting attempt. It's just hanging out somewhere where it can find fish.
It's interesting. There was an eagle on Lake Monona. On part of the lake was iced in, but there was open water, and there were probably 200 swans and of 100 or 2 Canada geese, and on the ice nearby was an eagle, probably chewing on something.
In addition to finding fish when it can, they certainly congregate at the large wildlife refuges where wintering waterfowl congregate, and geese in particular that are debilitated either by disease or injury or had been, you know, wounded during the hunting season, that's a primary source of food for wintering bald eagles further south from Wisconsin.
Yeah, there we go. There you go, Chris.
Yeah, actually we have, there's a lot of ponds around here that have geese that stay here all year round.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if that's why he's been hanging around here.
Well, seems like if I were him, that seems like a good idea.
Yeah. I had one more question about you. You had brought up the pheasants earlier, and I hunt the southern kettle moraine, you know, over by Scuppernog. I don't know if you know where that is, but they release a lot of pheasants over there. But they are all so fatty; they're all, you know, pen kept birds. That are they releasing those just for hunters, or are they releasing those to try to introduce those to the wild?
They're released primarily for the benefit of hunters. If a few do either move off of places like Bong or Scuppernong over there or other public areas and move on to private land, they may survive for a while. But as you say, they're pen-raised birds that are well-fed, and their survival rate, usually the hunters are remarkably efficient at combing them out of the landscape soon after they're put out, which is the reason they're put out. And their survival on their own, if they do escape the hunting season, which I guess ends today, some of them may make it. Obviously, released pheasants can and do survive because that's how they got here in the first place. When they were released in the Pacific Northwest 140 years ago, that was the genesis of all the pheasants scattered across the United States now. So, yes, stalking birds can produce a population, but that's not the intent of the birds that are put out by the DNR on the public hunting grounds.
Yeah, there you go, Chris. Thanks a lot for calling. And Jackie in Milwaukee. Hi, thank you for calling.
I'm not a hunter, but my mouth has been watering. But my question is kind of calm. I've lived here since 1954. Everybody gets squirrels. I have just had one who is red. He has red hair. He's a little bit smaller. He's spunky. How many different kinds of squirrels are there?
Well, there are quite a few. What you probably have is, in fact, a red squirrel, which is a very common northern forest tree squirrel. Does it have have you seen it close up? Does it have a little white ring around its eye?
I haven't had a chance to look at it. Whenever it
red squirrels kind of move down or move south in Wisconsin or exist in Wisconsin in kind of a curved distribution, and they work their way furthest south along the Lake Michigan shoreline. So it's smaller. They're very feisty and aggressive, and it probably is literally a red squirrel, which is
feisty. I thought first it was a chipmunk, but then they're beautiful. Okay. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
Well, so anyway, the rest of the answer, Larry, is that the common tree squirrel in the southern part of the state is a gray squirrel. They, of course, exist in several color phases, white, black, golden, yellow. We have a beautiful blonde one at our feeders right now, and then normal gray. Those are all the same species. Then fox squirrels, which are a little bit larger and are gray but have rusty brown extremities and belly. And then the red squirrel, the two species of flying squirrel, and then all the different ground squirrels, like the two chipmunks and the 13-line ground squirrel. So the squirrel family is a big group in Wisconsin.
Absolutely. We had a call from a DNR naturalist from Minnesota who said that she thinks the snow insects that were talked about earlier were probably springtails, which is a pretty good guess.
Yep.
Pretty good guess.
Either way, I don't think they were emanating from the deer.
No, I don't think so either. And here's an email from Kristen who says, I live in West Dallas on a 1/4 mile piece of land, including the house, and I have been adding more and more native plants and trees in the past 10 years. In just this small space, I have seen at least 19 species of birds, including towhee, brown thrashers, yellow-bellied sapsuckers, crossbills, seven species of butterflies, raccoons, deer, coyote, fox, opossum, toads, rabbits, voles, shrews, and a numerous variety of insects. I am still working on recording. This has really surprised as well as delighted me, so I believe it is possible to coexist with wildlife if each homeowner took the time to set aside part of their landscape for animals. I think it would be amazing what could happen for the beauty and health of our landscape.
Wow, that's really well said, and it's just a great example. That is absolutely
perfect.
True, and it gets back to the earlier question, lamenting people stomping on everything. The reality is that if more folks did that on their properties, the way she has done, the way
yep.
tried to do on our property south of Madison, the response is quick and incredible, and it's the old "if you build it, they will come" kind of mindset.
And on that note, we have to close. Oh my goodness, time is up. Scott, Happy New Year! Thank you so much, and we'll look forward to seeing you and talking with you in 2015. Thanks a lot.
Good. Yep. Bye bye.
Thank you. Scott Craven will be with us in 2015. I hope you will, too. I'll be here. Judith will be here. Happy New Year, everybody, and stay with us.